I'm here today at Unity Park, the newest urban green space in my hometown of Greenville, South Carolina. And it's a beautiful summer day, and you can hear the sound of happy children playing on the splash pad in the background. The park has something for everyone. It is huge and it is beautiful. But beyond the physical space of the park, there is also a strong stated intention that the park will unify the community. And there's also a promise of affordable housing options adjacent to the park. Still, there are those who remain skeptical. They wonder if over time Greenville will be able to realize this intention of unity, or they wonder if the inexorable pressures of gentrification will eventually destroy that promise of unity. In this episode, we are going to discuss the concept of eco-justice and explore the question, justice for whom? This is the State of Inclusion podcast, where we explore topics at the intersection of equity, inclusion, and community. In each episode, we meet people who are changing their communities for the better, and we discover actions that each of us can take to improve our own communities. I'm Amy Sanders. Welcome. So today, we're happy to welcome Rebecca Bolick-Wade. Rebecca is pursuing her Master's of Natural Science and Environmental Education, and she's currently working with a conservation organization here in the upstate, and she's focused in her work on clean water. So Rebecca has joined us today to have a discussion about eco-justice, and I had the great opportunity to participate in a workshop that she hosted, and I really felt like this was a great topic for our podcast and that she'd be a great guest. So welcome, Rebecca.
Hi, Amy. Thank you so much for having me on today. It's wonderful to be able to talk about this with you.
So this is a really complicated and difficult subject. One step about being able to make change in your community is having shared language for things. And I know one of the things we'll need to do as we go through today is we'll need to talk a little bit about the terminology we use and maybe relearn some terminology that we may or may not be using correctly. But first thing I want to ask you is, tell us a little bit about yourself. What are you studying, your work, and what really interests you?
Absolutely. So I am currently studying for a master's in environmental education. So I started this program in the summer of 2020, and a lot has happened culturally since then. And I had a very unique opportunity in that with my program, they tailored a lot of the coursework to be representative of what's happening culturally. So with that, a huge jumping off point for all the different classes I was in was to consider environmental education in the context of diversity, equity, and inclusion. And this made a very clear pathway in really grappling with issues of justice and diversity within environmental sectors as a whole. So with that, I really got involved with eco-justice, and that was what kind of sent me down a downward spiral of research and a lot of interest and consumed a lot of my thoughts and my time since then. But aside from what I'm doing for my studies, I actually started working at Upstate Forever in January of this year when I was really getting into the heart of a lot of this research. And it was really amazing to have the opportunity to think about these questions pertaining to justice, inclusivity, and conservation within the context of working with an environmental conservation group that is doing a lot to try to tailor our mission to be representative of diverse communities now. So I think that this is a wonderful jumping off point in terms of what I'm going to go on to study and keep doing with my thesis for my master's, and also what I hope to kind of grow into more with my role at Upstate Forever.
So this is probably a good spot for us to talk about terminology. So yeah. You threw out some phrases there in your description of what you're doing that not all of us are familiar with. So you used words like eco-justice, environmentalism, or environmental justice, and conservation. Maybe you can just take a minute and kind of define those three terms for us and what's similar or different about them.
Absolutely. So before I get into the definitions, I want us all to be thinking about these terms in terms of the question of justice for who. And I think that is a really important thing to keep in mind, because a lot of these topics can, and definitions can get a little nitty gritty. And unfortunately, we are going to get a little bit philosophical. So it's important to keep that in mind as well. So ecojustice is defined as the understanding that local and global ecosystems are essential to all life. It challenges the deep-rooted cultural assumptions that underline modern thinking and understanding those modern systems. And it's the recognition that we need to restore the cultural and environmental commons. And we'll kind of get into that more, so I think, in a minute. But the commons essentially are what is referred to as non-monetized relationships, practices, and traditions. So they can be environmental and cultural. But in other words, they're the things that we can't really sell, we can't really buy, but we are just given and we receive and we try to maintain. So if you've ever heard of the theory, tragedy of the commons, have you ever heard of that before?
Nope.
Okay, so tragedy of the commons essentially is things like our water. Because you can't, you buy water at your house, but because you can't buy all of water, we can take as much as we want, we can pollute it as much as we want, because it's really not going to come back and hurt us in any sort of way. So the tragedy is that we can take and take and take and pollute and pollute and pollute. There's really no real consequence for one single person, but it's a tragedy of the entirety of those commons. But I jumped down a rabbit hole. I digress.
But that's good. So when you're saying commons, you're thinking about things that we share collectively that none of us own. So we're talking about the water, our environment, the land around us. Even though we may feel like we own a portion, we are caretakers of the whole of our ecosystem and in our environment. Are those the kinds of things that you're talking about?
Absolutely. And I think it's also important to compare that. Those are the environmental commons. And look at that also in terms of commons of culture. So the cultural commons. The cultural commons actually tend to be a lot of different traditions and heritage and practices and skills that are used to support mutual well-being that are we generally see like with indigenous cultures. So I've been reading this really great book lately. It's called Braiding Sweetgrass. I actually just finished it. And it's all about looking at how these cultural phenomenon and the act of giving and taking and receiving and maintaining heritage is also a form of commons as well.
So ecojustice is about the need to restore that cultural and environmental commons. So exactly. To be aware of it, to take care of it, to restore it, and to be caretakers of it.
Exactly. And if we think about it in terms of it is justice for the environment and for culture and for people, it puts those on a level playing field. So if we're thinking of justice for who, it's a collective justice. It's a collective justice in terms of really challenging the ways that modern thinking kind of drives us to devalue those things. And that's what ecojustice is a proponent for, is balancing those needs and targeting holistic solutions for people, for our culture, and for the environment.
So help me put that in perspective of a term like environmental justice or environmentalism, because they're not the same thing, right?
They're not. So environmental justice is defined as the fair treatment and meaningful involvement of all people, regardless of race, color, national origin, or income, with respect to their development, implementation and enforcement of environmental laws, regulations, and policy. So this field of justice and environmental justice, it looks at the fair allocation of environmental burdens on all people, regardless of their race, their ethnicity, or socioeconomic class. And that's because generally what we saw during the segregationist era of this country is that we localized polluting industry in our vulnerable minority communities. And there's a lot of ways that this was done, but essentially it was to kind of keep a lot of polluting industry out of white neighborhoods and out of affluent areas. And as a result, it really localized the burdens of those environmental pressures on people that were already vulnerable. And it did a lot to continue segregating them in a different way. So when we think about environmental justice, going back to the question, justice for who? It's justice for people. Because it's looking at justice in terms of fair allocation of those environmental burdens on all people, because they shouldn't be just localized to those minority areas.
Okay, so we've got two terms now. So we've got ecojustice, which is about the commons, either cultural or environmental, and our caretaking and sharing and effective use of those. Then we have environmental justice, which assumes that there is some cost to our existence on the environment and that we need to more equally share that burden across different groups of people. Is that fair so far?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
I think another way to think about environmental justice is that it is a solution or essentially a reaction to unjust segregationist policy, which essentially was what governmental authority used to really continue to segregate people. So important and so deeply entrenched in a lot of work yet to be done. Environmental justice is super important, but if you think about it, it's just justice for people in terms of the environment being used as the weapon.
There's one other term that I want to get out here at the risk of defining too much stuff up front, scaring people off. I wanted to get another term out, which is conservation. So you work in an organization you described as a conservation organization. So how is that similar to or different from eco-justice and environmental justice?
In a lot of ways, when I was weighing the differences between environmental justice and eco-justice, I was like, we are really stuck in a loop of philosophy and education and conversation, but where's the action? Where is the application of these theories? And that's kind of where conservation came in, because conservation science is a field of study that seeks to understand the impacts of humans on other species, habitats, and ecosystems. So it really just seeks to prepare people to protect and restore those parts of nature that humanity values. In addition to that, it also is representative of interdisciplinary application of principles and tools to really help in this matter. So it applies political science, psychology, biology, economics, and all these things, and creates a holistic solution to these problems. So when I was thinking about eco-justice and just kind of where research is at that point with eco-justice, there's not a lot of application of this theory. There's a lot of conjecture and a lot of conversation, which is a great start, but I'm always about the action. And in addition to that, conservation is over here kind of balancing these two factors out, because this is kind of the playing field where a lot of these issues come together. So as we're trying to protect and restore the environment, are we doing that for the environment for itself? Are we doing that for people in general? Or are we focusing on helping the environment for itself and also to help vulnerable communities? So that's why I kind of chose to put conservation in on this conversation, because it grounds it in something that's actionable.
One of the things I really like about what you've just told us is your work centers around and asks the question of benefit and priority for who. And that's a little bit of the work that I do as well. So I find that very interesting. And I guess maybe I would ask you if you could help us. Can you ground some of these concepts in examples? Can you give us something maybe in our own community or some other community that you've studied or been part of that you think we could better see these three different concepts?
Absolutely. I think the most ideal playing field for these concepts to come together is looking at the influx and prioritization of urban green space. So urban green space is generally what we see with public parks and things like that. It's a place to prioritize different environmental variables like riparian buffers, stormwater management, replanting native species, taking out invasive species, and especially a lot down here in the upstate of South Carolina, we see a lot of this kind of going along on streams. So they also, in addition to that, repair a lot of streams and replant those and help essentially restore those streams and those rivers in tandem with creating urban green space for people to come and enjoy those. And I think that this is a really ideal playing field for this, because if we think about who is urban green space for, it's ideally for everyone, right? And I think a lot of research, especially in modern environmental justice, looks at how urban green space actually has the highest and most impactful increases on quality of life for our vulnerable communities. It's a free and equitable space for people who might not have the transportation or the funds to go to a privately owned green space to go out and enjoy all the beautiful things that the environment provides us, which is fresh air, community, place to be with your family, and also a place to exercise for free. And all of these things have resounding and the most impact on people that are the most vulnerable, which are our minority communities and our low-income communities. However, when we think about long-term, who is this benefiting? What we generally see is that this benefits the people that can actually afford to live there going forward. Because with this, we see surrounding urban green space, that's a really big potential area that new business and new enterprises to surround that, because there's going to be more people congregating in a sense of community. But that, as a result, ends up driving up the price of the cost of living around those urban green spaces. And even if they're put there for the purpose of helping our vulnerable communities, long term, that increases gentrification pressures and inevitably displacement. So when we think about who we value, especially when we put in urban green space and we're thinking about eco-justice and environmental justice, what tends to happen is we aren't valuing the long-term or thinking about the inevitable impact of putting those spaces for those people, which is that they can't be there long-term to enjoy it. And so we see a lot, this is like such an ideal playing field for conservation as a whole, because not the easiest way, but one of the most holistic ways to do conservation and promote environmental services is the promotion of urban green space and utilizing green space in high density areas. It makes people value those things. But it comes down to an eco-justice issue, because we are thinking about the long term in terms of the consequences that it's going to have for our vulnerable communities.
So what you're telling us is when we think about actions that we believe are conservation oriented, maybe even oriented at dealing with environmental justice issues and challenges, that we should be thinking for the long term and how this is going to play out over time, not just the immediate objectives that we might state on the surface, but who is going to benefit from this over time and how can we sustain the benefit for either everyone or for the targeted groups that we might be trying to reach or improve their life with these, you know, urban green spaces or whatever it is that we're working on. Is that the kind of the takeaway?
Absolutely. And the most impactful and genuinely the easiest way to do that and to have that solution is to really get just involve stakeholders in those communities that are going to be most impacted and possibly displaced. Because a lot of time what we see in terms of city planners is that they aren't necessarily representative of the vulnerable communities that they do have the intention of helping. And there really oftentimes isn't an intentional effort to bring them into the conversation and the development of those urban green spaces or things similar to that. And that's why there sometimes is a lot of pushback from members of diverse communities in that they don't want urban green spaces or community parks and things like that, because they do understand that eventually will create generate displacement. And That's the hard balance that we have to deal with. And the easiest way is just to incorporate them and let them be representative of themselves and their own communities and needs.
There are no easy answers for this, are there?
No.
One sort of case study that you and I talked about when we were at a workshop together was this idea of tree canopy. Mm-hmm. You know, we talked about the fact that right now in many cities, the distribution of the tree canopy is not equally distributed, meaning that if you live in more affluent or high income areas, you tend to have more trees, more shade, it's cooler, it's not as hot now that we're experiencing climate change effects and those kinds of things. And in lower income areas, we have denser housing, less tree canopy, and as a result, it's a more difficult place to live, less pleasant also, but it's hotter, less good air quality, those kinds of things. But then we heard one group talk about how, and in our community, they've implemented something that is, you know, there's a charge for getting rid of trees. So it encourages developers to keep trees. But we heard one group talk about how much more expensive it makes the development of low-income housing. So we desperately need more low-income and affordable housing and workforce housing. But there's a cost if they have to remove trees, and keeping the trees has a cost as well. So there's no easy answer for that. It's pretty complicated.
It is. And also part of that is it just makes one extra box there that developers for affordable housing have to check to be able to produce that, especially in an era of such widespread development in this area. If it is not going to be something that is easy to do or easier to implement and you're not going to get as much money out of it as a developer, disincentivizing to be able to do that.
Yeah. So it presented several trade-offs that you have to look at. That was a very interesting case study to me because one is personally highly value tree canopy. I live in an area of our community that's sort of like an urban forest. But I know personally it costs a lot to maintain those trees and to keep them healthy because they still are under a lot of stress being in an urban area. So I know it costs a lot to maintain them. I know that if we want to build, as you're saying, these affordable housing solutions across our community, make more housing available. As you said, the developers got another box to check, another cost to their project. And we had a very thoughtful group develop our policy around that. These were, I mean, we had some people in the room that day that we were talking about it, and they didn't do this willy-nilly. They thought very hard about what would be the best thing, yet there were still unintended consequences from what they put in place and what they proposed. So it suggests to us that your point earlier about bringing the people who are affected by this into the conversation is really critically important, and then being very deliberate about this, and then being willing to change when you find that the solution is not working for what you want to achieve, or that it has negative unintended consequences, be willing to find a way, or be willing to say, I'm going to make a change to this, or I'm going to make exceptions to this in these certain cases, because it's very difficult to get it right, I think, the first time.
Exactly. And something that I found really profound is that the people who are organizing this, their reaction to this is that they are improving it. There are monthly discussions going on currently with a lot of different stakeholders involved to refine this. Because essentially what we're seeing, like the first, I think you remember the first solution that was proposed for this was to essentially allow affordable housing developers to not have to pay the fine if they have to remove trees. So then again, we're just going to keep seeing less tree canopy disproportionately in affordable housing developments, which is not the solution. But I think currently, they really are trying to work out that if how they can possibly use the fine monies generated from the fines for people that do remove those trees to help replant trees in affordable housing developments and help them meet those needs. And I'm really excited to see what they come out with, because I think this is, and I like to say, unintentional eco-justice theory coming out. And it's really cool to watch.
But it does remind you that when you have people who have the right motivations and the right spirit, and they align around a goal like better tree canopy, for example, and hold in their head at the same time the need to create affordable housing, the need to maintain tree canopy, the need to respect what we hear from the communities that are affected by this, when they hold all those things in their head, you can reach a better solution. So beside our own little community, or maybe in addition to our own little community, what are some of the communities that are doing a really good job at this? That if, you know, somebody's listening to this, they think, who should I be watching? You know, what are some of the communities that are doing a great job and that we should be considering, or maybe I should even be knocking on their door to talk to them too?
I currently am doing a lot of different webinars and workshops with the Urban Waters Learning Network. This was kind of something that I started doing with my current role in clean water work, is looking at how to be more equitable about water. These workshops really are cool because they bring together people from all over the country to kind of give presentations on what they are doing to really, and they don't say it, but they're promoting eco-justice. They are doing eco-justice in person. But I think probably two of the most profound areas that I have come across with this resource are Athens, Georgia. There's called the Athens Land Trust. It essentially is a land trust that works in urban areas to help create a housing fund to promote affordable housing. So a lot of times what we see here in Greenville and the upstate as a whole is land trusts work to conserve large swaths of untouched land to keep them undeveloped. But land trusts can also be used to help create affordable housing and mitigate the pressures of gentrification and displacement. So Athens is really cool. In addition to that, another area is in Portland, Oregon. The organization is called Living in Coley. It is actually about a neighborhood called the Coley neighborhood, which is minority, and low-income communities that actually come together and work with conservation organizations to promote stormwater management, riparian buffers, and all these different conservation initiatives, but also that it's prioritizing giving jobs and conservation to the people that are being impacted by it in those neighborhoods. But both of those are great resources, and there's so much to learn more from the Urban Waters Learning Network because they talk to people all over the country about this.
Wow, those are great examples. And I'm going to tell you, I'm always happy to hear an example that helps us address gentrification, because I think across the country, so many communities, not just Greenville, South Carolina, where we are, but all across the country, people are experiencing gentrification and struggling with that in communities to find solutions. So it's always nice to hear a community that has approached this in a creative and thoughtful way. And then I like the Portland example in engagement and involvement of the communities that are affected. And then also seeing the jobs going to people who are affected by that's really cool. So both of those are great examples. Thank you for sharing that, because it also brings home what this really looks like in communities. Because the people who are listening to this podcast are people who want to make their communities better. And so this gives them some practical examples of how that's happening in other communities and how they're being successful. So thank you for that. As we kind of think about wrapping up a little bit, one of the questions I would ask you is, what advice would you give to people who are wanting to make their community stronger in terms of eco-justice and conservation?
I would recommend, first and foremost, anybody listening to this, which I'm sure you have a very introspective and thoughtful group of people listening to you, I recommend that everybody take a moment and really sit with these concepts and really sit with the fact that we are all living in a world that has created and maintained these issues. And it's hard to put it in perspective of how it has impacted your life and your standing. But sitting here as a middle-class white woman, I know I've had an easier hand given to me, not for anything that I truly deserved, you know? And it's hard reckoning and recognizing that in your own life, but taking a moment and really internalizing how, I like to say that the game has been rigged from the beginning for some of us. And when we recognize that, it creates an environment where we are all a little bit more introspective and perpetuates a lot more humility. And I think that's the jumping off point for me in being able to teach this and talk about this with people, is because I've experienced it and I've had to go through a change in how I feel and perceive these things. Secondly, I always tell people, don't fall into the pattern and the allure of using buzzwords. I have been in a lot of conversations and a lot of groups where people use a lot of this terminology, diversity, equity, inclusion, environmental justice, and eco-justice, entirely interchangeably. And I think it's really important that everybody take a moment and be very careful. And even if you say it wrong, take a moment and say, I misspoke. I actually meant this. And give yourself that space to be able to correct. And lastly, just support and emphasize the value of organizations that are working with interdisciplinary approaches to developing solutions for problems. So one of my favorite organizations in the upstate is called Sustaining Way, and they are cream of the crop as far as looking at issues of gentrification, displacement, social justice, and conservation, all on an equal playing field. Because I think when we do that, when we help advance those organizations, it advances a lot of these initiatives farther. So that's what I would recommend.
Wow, those are three good tips for us. I want to visit the first one you talked about in terms of taking a moment to sit with this and to understand that the game has been rigged, as you said, because I was just reading a book on adaptive leadership. And one of the things that book emphasized is you need to give up the notion that you have broken systems. We don't really have broken systems. We have systems that are working exactly as they were either designed or have evolved to work. And they are benefiting exactly who they were designed or have evolved to benefit. And so we need to think about that when we want to make change, because we need to be willing to say, that is how the system is working now. It's not a mistake. It's not an accident. it is how it is set up. And if we want to make changes, then we need to make changes to that system. And that's a complicated process and takes a long time on something as complicated as what we're talking about. I also think this notion of buzzwords is something I struggle with every day, and making sure that we used some time in this episode to try to define the terms that we're talking about and give examples, real concrete examples of what we mean. Because sometimes even when we define them, the definitions are still sound like jargon to people who don't really know what we're talking about. So you need to bring it home with real concrete examples. And then, of course, I loved your plug for supporting organizations that are working in this space. And that's something that when we have the means to do that, we can make those choices in our giving and in our giving of money, but also of our time. You know, we can volunteer with them and promote them and talk about them as well. So those are three good tips for the listeners to take away. So maybe, Rebecca, maybe you would take a minute and just say, so what's next for you? So we started out by talking about what you're studying, what you're doing. Where do you want to go with this? And what do you see yourself doing?
I've been thinking about that question. And it's obviously something that's been in the background of my mind now for a little while, because I am set to finish this program in a month, which is wild. And I'm rapidly approaching my deadline for this research and this capstone thesis. And I think the main thing is, I really want to take this work and this motivation and what I've learned to really try to advance conversations amongst and between different organizations, especially in the conservation sector. Because at least from what I've experienced working in a lot of different places, a lot of different roles, is people in conservation and environmental work as a whole sometimes don't feel like they know how to talk about these things. And it leads to a lot of quiet, where there needs to be a lot more conversation. So I really hope, maybe, and I'm still trying to brainstorm the best way to do this, but to continue to advocate for this way of thinking about things and really introduce people to ways of thinking and discussing these topics that encourage them to be a voice and an advocate for this stuff as well.
That sounds exciting. And I'm really, really happy for you. I'm happy that you're about to finish your program. And, you know, Rebecca, I love finding emerging thought leaders on subjects that are related to equity and inclusion. And it was really good to be able to meet you and understand the work that you're doing, and then have you join us on the podcast. And I just want to thank you for the work you're doing, and thank you for taking time to talk with me today.
Thank you, Amy. The work you're doing is super important as well. And I'm just really grateful to be here.
This has been the State of Inclusion podcast. Join us again next time. And if you enjoyed this episode, the best compliment for our work is your willingness to share these ideas with others. So leave us a review. We'd love your comments. Thanks so much for listening.